dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WUS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Lansing, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week on the program, Bill Douglas of the 9/11 Visibility Project spoke about their campaign to get Democracy Now! To bring on guests who will challenge the 9/11 official story. In his presentation given in late May, Douglas announced that David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor, would soon be interviewed on Democracy Now! Well, he was. And if you heard the program, perhaps you were as frustrated as I was in that another guest was brought on simultaneously to attack him, resulting in us hearing almost nothing about the material regarding 9/11 itself that Griffin had to present. Tonight, you'll hear an in-depth, uninterrupted interview with David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor. And in our second hour, a former U.S. military pilot examines the question of the stand down of the interceptors on 9/11 and dares to call it treason.
Darkness and midnight, when the pot-bellied beast chased their unwelcome guests.
The interview you're about to hear was recorded on June 28th. The interviewer is Mariah Gallardon.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The New Pearl Harbor. The historian Howard Zinn said, David Ray Griffin has done admirable and painstaking research in reviewing the mysteries surrounding the 9/11 attacks. It is the most persuasive argument I have seen for further investigation of the Bush administration's relationship to that historic and troubling event. End of quote. If the events of 9/11 had occurred the way the Bush administration says they did, it would have been the first time in history that an event that led up to war occurred without manipulation. From the sinking of the Maine in the harbor of Havana to the fabricated attacks on American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin, and, according to historian Gore Vidal, Pearl Harbor itself, these events are remembered as manufactured news. Why would 9/11 be different? David Ray Griffin lists 40 incidents that raise serious doubts about the official version, and he covers some of them in the interview you are about to hear. David Ray Griffin has been a professor of philosophy of religion at the Claremont School of Theology in Southern California for over 30 years. We began by talking about the interim report of the 9/11 Commission and Griffin's comments on Fahrenheit 9/11. Let's start with the official 9/11 Commission. When I began the TUC radio series on 9/11 about 10 weeks ago, I referred to the many unanswered questions that need to be addressed. Meanwhile, the official 9/11 investigation left us with a huge number of unquestioned answers. Would you like to comment on the official investigation as it stands now at the end of June 2004?
Well, a lot of people had referred to the so-called 9/11 Independent Commission as the 9/11 Cover-Up Commission, I mentioned that label in my book, but I did not endorse it. But I'm afraid now that the weeks have gone by and the public hearings have ended, that it does look like that indeed is the case, because they simply refused to ask any of the really disturbing questions. And like you say, they refused to question any of the answers they had begun with. For example, when the NORAD officials say that they didn't expect this kind of attack from inside, and that all of their radar was really pointed outward, as if the Cold War were still going on. First of all, that seems just very implausible, given their own statements on their websites as to how sophisticated their equipment is, and how, for example, they say that the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon says that their equipment is so sophisticated that it could monitor many, many missiles coming from, you know, submarine-launched missiles simultaneously, and that if they could do that, they could not monitor three or four airliners because they were looking outward, is just implausible. And furthermore, that would be easy to check, but they've done no checking. They've done no serious subpoenaing. As far as we can tell, there's been no serious questioning of the word of government officials.
There's one more thing that happened since your book appeared earlier this year in 2004, and that's the release of Michael Moore's film, Fahrenheit 9/11. Do you have any comments on that movie?
Well, I think, like at least many people who have seen it, I think it's mixed. On the one hand, for people who haven't been following the issues very closely, I think it's a real eye-opener. Moore gets to several very important facts that have been not widely publicized by the mainline media. And so I think his movie will have quite an impact. And even though, for the most part, he seems simply to assume the orthodox theory about the attacks, that is, that they were carried out by 19 Arab Muslim hijackers, I think his movie will create a general air of skepticism about 9/11, and therefore open up people to pursuing the issue further, and so therefore perhaps being willing to read books such as mine that summarize the arguments against the official account. Some people have asked me about smoking guns, and I hadn't used that terminology, but then because that question has been raised so much, I went back and went through the book and said, now what do I think at least are prima facie smoking guns, things that on the surface of it appear to be very incriminating facts that, if they were really explored, would lead to the conclusion there was government complicity. And I was rather surprised that I came up with so many, that I came up with a list of 40. So Moore's movie, I would say, may have dealt with three or four of those at the most. So certainly I would have a lot. Let me give one example. Many people have thought the most effective part of his movie was simply his playing the video of President Bush in the classroom listening to the students read about their pet goat for about 7 minutes after he learned that the second tower had been hit. Now, that's significant because after the official story is that he didn't learn about the first tower being hit until he got to the school at 9 o'clock and passed that off as a horrible accident. So no indication that he believed that it was part of some larger terrorist attack. But clearly when Andrew Card came in and told him about the second one, then there could be no doubt in anybody's mind that America was under attack, again, if we're accepting the official story. And yet, he sat there, and Michael Moore did mention in the movie that that the Secret Service did not hustle him off. But I would have made much more of that, because I think that's the most significant thing there. You'll remember that later in the day, after they went to Air Force One and took off, then the president stayed away from Washington for many hours. And he was widely criticized because some people said, well, he seems to be afraid. But the crucial issue was that for that first hour while they were at the school, there seemed to be no fear whatsoever. We're told that Vice President Cheney, when they thought the White House was in danger, was lifted up bodily by two Secret Service guys who hustled him downstairs to the underground bunker. And yet, surely the President of the United States, if this were a genuine terrorist attack, would be the number one target. And everybody in the country who was paying attention knew where he was, because he was scheduled to give a TV broadcast at about 9:30 that morning. And yet the Secret Service just allowed him to stay there in plain sight with no military planes flying over, no protection whatsoever. Now, when Bush was asked about this, he said, well, I wanted to project calm so I wouldn't frighten the children. But wouldn't the most important thing be get out of there to protect the children? Because if terrorists had struck, probably all 200 people at the school would have been killed. So the story is very implausible and suggests that the Secret Service, whoever was the head of the Secret Service, knew that they were not targets.
Would you present us with just one more of your 40 smoking gun incidents?
Well, one certainly is parents' stand down, the failure to have normal operating procedures in effect on 9/11. Another would be the whole story about the Pentagon, all the evidence that suggests rather than it being Flight 77 that hit it, which was a Boeing 757, that it was some much smaller aircraft and indeed a military aircraft. And yet another would be the collapse of all three buildings of the World Trade Center, not only the Twin Towers that everybody knows about, but also Building 7, which in some respects is more significant yet. So we could talk about any of those.
Okay, why don't we talk about the failure to intercept? Because the reaction to my particular radio series has been the strongest on that one example. And I was really impressed by the way you present this particular incident in your book, because you say, quote, in light of standard procedures for dealing with hijacked airplanes, however, not one of these planes should have reached its target, let alone all three of them. Can you pick it up from there?
Well, yes. Let's take the first flight, Flight 11, because in some respects that's the toughest case, because one might argue, well, they were surprised by this. So let's look at the figures and standard operating procedure. Standard procedure is if there is any sign that a plane is possibly hijacked, that is, it goes radically off course, they lose radio contact, or the transponders are turned off, the FAA ground controller is supposed to notify NORAD and the National Military Command Center. That's a really simultaneous notification immediately, and that usually happens within a minute. And then NORAD is assigned the task of deciding what is the closest military base and ordering two jet fighters to be scrambled, that is, sent up to intercept. And that normally takes another minute to give that order. And then, according to NORAD itself, these jets, particularly the F-15s, can go from scramble order to 29,000 feet in 2.5 minutes. And then they travel at 1,850 miles an hour, so they can intercept planes very quickly, and normally within 10 to 15 minutes anywhere in the United States. And yet that morning, they knew at 8:14 that this flight was possibly hijacked, and it was not until 8:46 that it hit the North Tower. In other words, 32 minutes passed, and no plane was even within sight of it. And in fact, according to NORAD, and here it gets more complex because we have to say according to the second version of NORAD's story, the scramble order wasn't given until 2 minutes before 8:46, and so the jets didn't really have a chance. So that's certainly one of the questions that should have been pressed much more at the 9/11 Commission than it was. They just accepted the idea that there was somehow mass confusion and mass incompetence. And now the military, NORAD, is saying if the FAA had told us in time, sure, we could have intercepted. And the FAA is saying, we believe we told them in time. And so somebody clearly is not telling the truth there, and yet there was no real pressure to find out who it was, if anyone was telling the truth. And if the FAA controllers had waited until 8:40, as NORAD claims, that would have been 26 minutes. This would have been gross incompetence, even criminal negligence. These people should have been prosecuted. They certainly should have been fired, but nobody was even publicly reprimanded. So it's hard to believe the incompetence theory.
In all these delays, the most inexplicable one is not to have scrambled for the flight that supposedly approached the Pentagon.
That's right. Just to mention Flight 175 very quickly, the FAA did, according to the timeline, notify NORAD in a prompt way with that, and yet NORAD says the flights didn't take off until 8:52, and the South Tower was hit at 9:03. And yet, if you do the math there, the flights still should have gotten there in time, given the speed at which they can go. And yet, the official story is that they were 70 miles away when the South Tower was hit. But that story should feed right then into the story about the Pentagon, because according to the official account, it was at 8:46 that Flight 77 went off track, and then at 8:50 lost radio control, and then at 8:56 they tell us they saw it turn around on the radar and head back towards Washington at 8:56. So at 7 minutes later, these two fighters were presumably coming to New York. New York is very close to Washington at those speeds. Those jets should have been sent immediately to protect Washington, to protect the nation's capital. And yet they weren't. They were sent back home, again, according to the official story. And then no other jets were scrambled, although Andrews Air Base is just 10 miles from the capital. No airplanes were scrambled from there. Now, NORAD, again, according to the second version, maybe I should explain that. One of the smoking guns is the very fact that there were two versions. The first 3 days, the military was saying that they did not send up any planes until after the Pentagon was hit at 9:38. That would obviously be a gross violation of standard operating procedures, and maybe because that would have been so obvious, the story got changed, and they started saying, oh, yes, we did scramble airplanes, but they got there too late. So almost everything you read about is this second version, and we don't even know if there's any truth to it whatsoever. But again, taking the second version as if it were true, and playing it out, we see that NORAD ordered the planes to be scrambled not from Andrews, but from Langley, which was over 100 miles away, and that's supposed to explain why they didn't quite get there in time. Nevertheless, if again you do the math, you find out that even by their own timeline, there was plenty of time to get there. So if the planes really flew, and if they were as late as they said they were, the planes must have been going no more than 500 or 600 or 700 miles an hour rather than 1,850. So whatever part of the story you look at, it simply doesn't compute.
There's a chapter in your book called What Hit the Pentagon, and there is a reference to a number of photos that were taken right after the impact that are actually available for viewing on the internet, and anybody listening to this program can go to the website of TUC Radio and find a link in the newest programs section and sort of follow along looking at the photos of that were initially taken. The website for TUC Radio is www.tucradio.org, and you can follow the conversation by looking at a photo, for instance, taken by Tom Horan of the Associated Press took a photo just after the fire trucks had arrived, but before the firemen had been deployed, so right after the impact. And in that photo, the West Wing's facade hadn't collapsed yet. And there are fire trucks to be seen in the photo, and there's a pretty pristine green lawn all the way up to the building without any scratches in it. And there isn't any sign of any airplane, no fuselage, no tail, no wings, no engines, nothing.
That's right. And in fact, there is a website called Hunt the Boeing, because when you see how small the hole was that was created by whatever hit the Pentagon, only the nose of a Boeing 757 would have gone inside. Therefore, the rest of it should have been out there on the lawn ready to be photographed, and yet there is no sign of it whatsoever. Now, to put this in context, let me back up. When I first was getting into this, I had learned about the first two flights, but then I heard about this Terry Masson, this French writer, who had argued that what hit the Pentagon was not a Boeing 757, but a missile. And I thought, well, that must be absurd, because if it were a missile, how could... I mean, the size of a missile is so different from that of a Boeing 757. How could they possibly have convinced the press and the American public and people in Washington that it was Flight 77? And still, many people today, when they hear that theory, they just use that as self-evidently absurd. But what people need to ask is, what evidence do they have that it was Flight 77, and that it therefore was a Boeing 757? And in actual fact, the only evidence for that theory is that the Pentagon says so. There is no physical evidence to support that. Now, many people say, oh, yes, we know because Barbara Olson called and said her flight, she was on Flight 77 and was headed towards the Pentagon. But in actual fact, we don't know that. First of all, Ted Olson did not say that she said, identified where the flight was, but only that she was on the flight and that hijackers had taken control of it. There's no mention about the idea that it's going to Washington. Secondly, all we know is that Ted Olson told us that. And, of course, he has been the chief attorney for the Bush administration, and he has also publicly, before the Supreme Court, defended the legitimacy of lying to the public. So at least one must take that with a grain of salt. So if we dismiss that, then one can see that there is no other evidence. And if you look at all the physical evidence, it supports another theory. As you mentioned, the hole that was created in the facade that was taken by another photograph was taken by a Marine, and it shows that the hole was no more than 18 feet in diameter. Now, we know that a Boeing 757 has a wingspan of 125 feet about, and it's about 40 feet high. So at going at 400 miles an hour, it would have created a tremendous hole in the Pentagon. And indeed, that's evidently what the Pentagon put out, because the next day, September 12th, the Washington Post had a story in which it said the hole that was created was 5 stories high and 200 feet wide. And I checked with one of the authors of this and asked him where he got that information, and he said he didn't remember, but most plausibly he got it from the Pentagon itself. Now, that is about the size of a hole that the 757 would create, but unfortunately the physical evidence shows that's not what happened. And then, as you mentioned, there is other physical evidence. There is other eyewitness testimony. The fire chief was asked the next day what remains of the Boeing he saw inside the Pentagon, because obviously it wasn't outside, so it had to have gone inside. And he said, well, I didn't see any big pieces, no fuselage, no engines, no wings. Now, a month later, his memory got refreshed, and he swore that he saw these things. He even said he saw some things that, according to the Pentagon, hadn't been found yet, like the black box. So we can be more certain, I think, of his immediate testimony than the testimony he gave a month later when there'd been time to put some pressure on him. But there were other witnesses who also said they saw nothing. So there's all that evidence. And then, from my point of view, the most decisive thing is the very fact that whatever it is that hit the Pentagon, hit the Pentagon. That is, had it been a commercial airliner, it would have been shot down automatically, because the Pentagon, probably the most defended place on the face of the earth, is lined with batteries of missiles. And they are set to shoot down anything that does not radiate a friendly signal from its transponder. The only thing that would radiate a friendly signal would be some sort of U.S. military aircraft. So that's what leads many of us to believe that whatever it was, and it's immaterial really whether it was a missile or a small military aircraft, the important thing is all the evidence suggests it was not only relatively small, but it must have been a military aircraft.
In this part of the interview, Griffin comments on the amazing fact that prior to 9/11, no steel-framed high-rise building ever collapsed due to fire. And yet, on 9/11, 3 buildings collapsed: the Twin Towers and building number 7 a block away. We started by talking about building number 7.
There have been some enormous fires that have completely gutted such buildings. No building has ever collapsed. And yet on that day, it did 3 times, according to the official story. But focusing only on building number 7, even if one wants to say, well, maybe a really enormous fire could bring down a steel frame building, let's say we even granted that for the sake of argument, there was no enormous fire in building number 7. And yet, at 5:20 in the afternoon, it collapsed all of a sudden, and collapsed within less than 15 seconds. Furthermore, it collapsed in what is called classic style, according to controlled demolition. Controlled demolition is when you place explosives throughout the building at all the vital spots to bring the building straight down so it does not fall on neighboring buildings. And these have to be placed not only precisely, but they have to be set off in the proper order. So normally a computer would be used to set them off. And everyone who has looked at the collapse, and you can see these on many websites, I mentioned a few of them in my book, you see that this is a classic instance, or at least it mimics classic instances of controlled demolition. Furthermore, the company that was brought in to clean up the mess was actually called Controlled Demolition Incorporated. Another interesting fact, this company has advertised that it will break the steel beams and columns into pieces the appropriate size for your lifting equipment. And indeed, most of the beams, both from the Twin Towers and from building number 7, were broken into the size that they were just ready to load onto trucks. And here these buildings had these enormous columns in their central cores. If they could have collapsed, you would have had these enormous pieces of steel on your hands that all would have had to been cut, but evidently only a very few of them had to be cut.
I guess both the emotional attachment as well as the desperate desire of people to want to not be lied to presents a real hurdle at looking a little bit more closely at the collapse of these two buildings, because quite a few things that you just mentioned about building number 7 are true too for the Twin Towers. They shouldn't have collapsed either.
That's right. It's important to realize that even people who accept the official theory, if they know anything about these buildings and about engineering, say that the impact of the planes was really insignificant, because these buildings were tremendously redundant. They had 47 columns up the core, and then they had over 230 columns around the outside, all steel. And so the plane knocked out a few of those peripheral columns, but the weight would have been shifted to the rest. And so one must dismiss the impact of the airplanes. Furthermore, the buildings were completely stable within 30 seconds after impact. That means then that all the destruction had to be caused by the fires. One problem with this, and again, the press has not done his job, so I don't know, I have not met one person out of 100 who knows this. The wrong tower collapsed first. That is, we all know the North Tower was hit first, and the South Tower was hit about 17, 18 minutes later. And yet, the South Tower collapsed first. Now, I want to pause to give time for that to sink in, because any fire that, if we're going to say that maybe it didn't melt the steel because it didn't, the fire from jet fuel would not come close to the temperature required to melt steel, but many people say, well, it could have significantly weakened the steel. But if that had been the case, it takes a long time when you're talking about steel
you not only need an enormous fire, but it has to burn for a long time to heat up all the steel. And yet, the fire in the South Tower had only been going 56 minutes when the South Tower collapsed, whereas the fire in the North Tower went for an hour and 42 minutes, almost twice as long. So if you've got a fire theory, you've got a big problem because the North Tower should have collapsed first. Now, people might say, oh, but we've seen the fireball from the South Tower. When the plane hit, there was a tremendous explosion, tremendous fireball. So that plane must have had a lot more jet fuel in it. Well, what happened there was that plane didn't hit center on. It hit near the edge. And therefore, much of the fuel went outside the building rather than inside, and that's what created that enormous fireball. But that didn't last very long. What happened, therefore, was that a goodly percent of the fuel in that plane burnt up within 5 to 10 minutes. And so the fires in the South Tower were actually much smaller than the fires in the North Tower. And yet, the South Tower collapsed first within 56 minutes. That is one of the many features of the collapse of the towers that needs to be considered when anyone is trying to give a theory as to how they collapsed. But then there are all these other factors beyond the fact that no steel-framed high-rise building had ever collapsed by fire alone. There are at least 9 characteristics that fit controlled demolition. That is, both of the towers went down at almost free fall speed. That means that they collapsed almost as fast as if you had just dropped a brick from the top of one of the towers. That means that the upper floors were encountering virtually no resistance when they hit the lower floors. That could only be if the lower floors gave way because of controlled demolition. Furthermore, there was a total collapse. As I said, you had these enormous steel beams sticking way up into the air. And at the base, these beams were very wide and broad. So even if one accepts the official pancake theory, which is that somehow the collapse of the upper floors caused the floors below them to collapse, just like records on an old radio player with the spindle up the middle, you still would have had the spindle up the middle. That is, those 47 giant steel columns. And yet, anyone who's seen the photographs know, you had a total collapse with nothing more than, say, 3 stories high. You should have had these steel columns sticking hundreds of feet up into the air. Furthermore, most of the concrete in the buildings was turned to dust. Now, if you would have dropped a concrete block from the top of the building, it would not turn to dust. It would break into small pieces, but to pulverize concrete into dust takes a tremendous amount of energy, the kind of energy that would come from explosives. Furthermore, And this dust was enormous. People on the ground said that it was like walking in a foot or two of snow. Furthermore, this dust didn't just fall down. It ejected out from the building maybe more than 200 feet in every direction. That is, it was forced out horizontally. What could produce that kind of ejection, that kind of momentum, other than a tremendous amount of energy coming from the buildings themselves? Furthermore, people in the building said they heard explosions, or they felt explosions, or they saw the effects that seemed to be the effects of explosions. For example, there was a 100,000-pound steel press that a guy said was just curled up like flimsy steel. Furthermore, there is seismic evidence that there were significant explosions from the sub-basements. Furthermore, there was all this molten steel. People ask, why did it remain so hot under the rubble for such a long period of time. That would be consistent with molten steel having been created by very strong explosives. And then finally, a sign of a possible cover-up was the very quick removal of the steel. These steel beams are part of forensic evidence. They can be, one can examine them and see, was twinning produced, that is, a chemical reaction that is produced when steel is put up against explosives. And yet the steel was quickly removed and put on ships and shipped off to Asia, where it could not be studied. Now, how could they defend this? This is normally a federal crime to remove any material evidence from a crime scene. Well, they said, the city of New York said, we need to see if there are any victims under here, and that is more important now in case anybody might still be alive. But back to building number 7, it was evacuated, according to the official account, at about noon, and it was not until 5:20 that it collapsed. And so there was no reason to believe there would be any victims whatsoever under building 7, and yet the steel was removed from it just as quickly.
Is there an official report by FEMA about the Twin Towers as well as for Building 7?
If you read the report from the FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, you see that they have no explanation. And particularly with regard to Building Number 7, they're clearly embarrassed because they give a theory as to how beams, something might have fallen from the Twin Towers and gone through several walls and then got in touch with the diesel fuel and maybe some pumps malfunctioned and pumped the diesel fuel up to the fire, the floor where the fire was and so on. And after giving all that possible explanation, they say, but this has a very low level of probability. So FEMA itself admitted that, and here's sotto voce, they admitted, leaving out the possibility of controlled demolition, that there is no explanation whatsoever of why building number 7 collapsed. And then you add to the top of this rather remarkable statement by Larry Silverstein, who had recently leased these buildings and had taken out an enormous insurance policy on them from which he hopes to gain about $1 billion. He said on a PBS show, and this is beyond belief that he would have said this in public, but he did. He said, well, at a certain time, the fire chief called me and told me, we don't think we're going to be able to save building number 7, so we better evacuate it. And Larry Silverstein says, well, you know, we've had such loss of life, maybe the best thing to do is just go ahead and pull it. Well, pull is the slang term for controlled demolition, for bringing a building down with controlled demolition. And Silverstein went on to say, and so we made the decision to pull, and we sat there and watched the building collapse. So here you have an incredible statement, the owner of the building saying that they deliberately brought them down. Of course, that was done after FEMA had done its embarrassing report. And yet this has received no press in this country. This is incredible that here you have what many would call the crime of the century. You have this enormous mystery of how Building 47 could have been brought down by fire, particularly tiny little fires. And then you have the owner of the building saying, we brought it down deliberately, and yet nobody pays attention. There's no follow-up here. And, of course, what that suggests is if building number 7 came down, and then you look at the videos and you see that with some differences, because buildings, the Twin Towers collapsed from the top instead of from the bottom like building number 7 did. But apart from that and a couple other differences, you have the same pattern there with these buildings falling essentially straight down into their own footprint and, again, very quickly, almost free fall speed. The fact that Silverstein, seemingly publicly admitted that building number 7 was brought down by controlled demolition, wouldn't that mean that the two towers were brought down? But of course, this is unspeakable, because this would mean that those people were deliberately sacrificed for the sake of, and then you can fill that in as to what you think the motive might have been.
Why do you think there's still so much resistance to the views you express in your book?
Well, here we have to distinguish between resistance in the press, and of course in the government, and resistance among the public. I don't find much resistance among the public. All I find is ignorance, because the press has not informed them. But I find that when people read my book, virtually everyone that I have heard about has been convinced or at least greatly disturbed by it, saying, I fear it may be true, but I don't want to believe it, and so I won't. But nevertheless, most of the reaction to the book has been positive. For example, if you go on Amazon.com and read the customer reviews, right now there is about 78 of them, and 70 of them, I believe, have 5 stars. And so the public seems to be willing, particularly, I think, more recently, as people have realized the Bush administration has lied about Iraq. Some people know it also lied about Afghanistan as to the real reasons for going to war. And I explained those in my book, that this war was on the books long before 9/11 happened. And given the record, this record of lying, that more people are willing now to say, well, you know, maybe the Bush administration has lied about the initiating event, that is 9/11 itself.
You talk in your book about, you phrase it kindly as contradictory statements on 9/11 by the Bush administration. Which ones of these contradictory statements do you find most worrisome?
Well, it would be hard, I guess, to put those in order of priority. One that people know the most about is this statement that they had no inkling prior to 9/11 that airplanes might be used as terrorist instruments. That one was sufficiently debunked by the 9/11 Commission. So the 9/11 Commission did perform some service, and this was one thing, bringing out that there was far more advanced knowledge than the administration had wanted to admit. More serious than that was the claim that there was no specific knowledge. The administration is still saying this, even though they finally had to make public the August 6th memo, which talks about Bin Laden's group plans to use airplanes to attack within the United States. One might wonder how much more specific one can get than that. But yet, there were warnings that were even more specific. As I mentioned in the book, there are some FBI agents who went to David Shippers, who was the attorney who prosecuted Clinton, and therefore should have had good credibility in Republican circles. Shippers says that he tried to tell Attorney General Ashcroft that he had specific information about upcoming terrorist attacks. He says that these guys said Lower Manhattan and even had the dates right, and yet Ashcroft would not return his calls. He didn't want to know. Another bit of specific information, probably the most specific, is the fact that all these put options were purchased on United Airlines, American Airlines, and Morgan Stanley Dean Witter, which had 22 floors in the World Trade Center. Now, a put option is when you something you purchase on the stock market that is betting that the stock is going to go down. And, of course, the stock did go dramatically down after 9/11. Because those were the airlines whose planes were used in the attacks. And we have pretty good information that the CIA and probably other intelligence agencies monitor the stock market looking precisely for such warning signals. So here they would have had the warning that United American Airlines were going to be used in terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center. You can't get much more specific than that. And these put options were purchased just the 2 or 3 days prior to 9/11. And so they would have also known pretty closely about what day to expect it. So that is one set of lies that the American people should find very disturbing. Another apparent lie would be the claim that they did not shoot down Flight 93. We haven't talked about that, but the significance there is that whereas the question about the first three airplanes was why they were not intercepted and then, if they hadn't followed rules, shot down, it seems that Flight 93 is the one flight that should not have been shot down because it appeared the passengers were wresting control away from the hijackers, and yet it was shot down, and the government claimed that they did not shoot it down.
So what is missing now is an investigation. What kind of investigation can you envision that actually has subpoena power and resources to get to the bottom of it and get beyond the work of the official 9/11 commission?
Yes, well, it would either have to be a very serious investigation, say by the Senate, of the sort that was done in relation to Watergate and Iran-Contra. Or maybe it would have to be two stages. I suspect it would, that would have to be done enough to establish a prima facie case and then to appoint a special prosecutor. One question people ask is, if there were so many people involved in this, why haven't they come forward? Well, there are many answers to that. One is intimidation, threats. Another is there has been no environment created in this country for coming forward. In fact, just the opposite. Anybody who says this in public, any hint of this is immediately pilloried and discredited. But if you had a special prosecutor who was not only encouraging people to come forward, but also saying, if you were one of the lowerlings involved here and you fear that you may have some guilt, we will give you immunity for your testimony. I think something like that is probably the only way we will get to this. But a first step will have to be the American press will finally have to quit hiding this issue. Now, my book has come out, in fact, just this week officially in England, and already it has received considerable press coverage in that country. There has been a three-page story in the Daily Mail. I have been on one of the popular afternoon talk shows. I've been on radio over there as well, and I've participated in a documentary that is being made by British TV about this issue. And so already the English public know far more about this than the American public, even though my book came out in the United States in March. We have sent it to 200 to 300 journalists and editors and publishers, and yet not a one of them in the mainstream press has seemed fit even to mention the existence of the book, let alone give it a full review. And so until the press is willing to face up to this issue and the implications it has for the survival of democracy in this country, I'm afraid the Congress will not have the courage to go forward.
You heard David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor. Professor Griffin has taught philosophy of religion at the Claremont School of Theology in Southern California for over 30 years. You can find more information on David Ray Griffin on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this program with David Ray Griffin by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE.
Thanks to Mariah Gallardin for that recording. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 FM Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. A bit of comic relief on the end of elections in America. Then we'll hear a stirring and informative talk from Dr. Robert Bowman.
In episode 72 of The Adventures of Huckleberry Bush, President of the Known World, we journey to the Oval Office of the White House, where we find Count Cheney, Vice President of the Known World, in deep consultation with the President.
Well, under no circumstances shall I be caught in the Capitol after sunrise.
You'd shrivel up, right? Like a flatworm in a microwave.
A colorful description, but essentially accurate, George.
So tell me about that thing with Nehi.
Leahy, George. We were all in the Senate well. They were about to take our annual Senate portrait, so I was wearing makeup.
Or else you wouldn't show up in a picture, would you?
Oh, no. Glass is a pure substance, isn't it, Master?
Yes, Rumsfeld, it is. Since a camera lens is curved, I show up better than in a mirror, but I do need my makeup. Oh, some of the laws of a supernatural existence are a bit awkward. But into each death a little blood must...
So what happened with Lehi?
Senator Leahy began questioning me as though we were friends, as though I'd ever tell him anything about anything.
Yeah, what did you tell him?
Well, at first I forgot myself and told him that I'd rip out his liver and suck it dry before his dying eyes. But it was not the most diplomatic thing to say on the Senate floor, I'm afraid.
So you clouded his mind, didn't you?
I had to summon much power from the forces of evil.
You mean Satan?
No, I should never bother the boss with something so trivial. No, local evil. Rush, Imus, and Hannity. I had to cloud the minds of many senators. I made them believe that I suggested that Patrick commit an impossible sexual act upon himself.
You told him to go, rip himself?
That means what I suspect you mean. Yes.
That's pretty good. What?
George, it's that Scooter Libby again.
Better send him on in, Karen.
Master, Mr. Vice President.
Oh, hi, Mr. President. I can't get any work done.
Why would that be, Scooter?
Well, Andy Card's hiding under my desk so I can't sit down. Carl Rove dragged my computer into my curio case and won't give it back. And Wolfowitz is in my closet combing his hair with spit. At least I hope it's spit.
Well, Wolfie's kind of strange.
Even I think Wolfowitz is strange.
A Scooter, do we know why they are hiding?
It's the polls, Master. They're afraid we're going to lose the White
we
House.
We can't lose it. Look how big it
George,
is.
George, really. Scooter, tell them I'm meeting with Tom Ridge in a little bit, and we have a near-foolproof solution.
Well, that reminds me, Master. I found the HSD wandering around looking for you. He's carrying an old hat box.
Ah, excellent. Go tell Andy, Carl, and Paul to get back to work in their own offices. It's a direct order. And send Thomas in on your way out.
Yes, Master.
You sure this will work
Mr.
yet?
Director,
Ashcroft's people
in.
Have been working well, on thanks, it, and Scooter. It's looking quite well. Ah, sit down, Thomas. Donald, take Dr. Henry and put him here on the table.
Yes, Master.
Hi, Mr. President. Here, Don.
What?
Ouch, I think.